This episode is released in recognition of World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, and it's a good time to consider what is elder abuse. The World Health Organization definition of elder abuse is a single or repeated act or lack of appropriate action occurring within any relationship where there is an expectation of trust which causes harm or distress to an older person. The World Health Organization definition highlights the expectation of trust, which is what I want to focus on in this episode today. Today, I am joined by the New South Wales Ageing and Disability Commissioner, Mr. Robert Fitzgerald. Robert, a lawyer by profession, brings a significant amount of experience to this role, having been previously appointed as a Productivity Commissioner, Community and Disability Services Commissioner, and Deputy Ombudsman in New South Wales. For more than 30 years, the Commissioner has been involved in a voluntary capacity in numerous community services, including President of the Australian Council of Social Service, State President of St. Vincent de Paul Society, New South Wales, Board Director, Families Australia, the Association of Children's Welfare Agencies, FOIA Foundation, New South Wales Council of Social Service, Benevolent Society, and Social Ventures Australia. Robert holds degrees in commerce and law from the University of New South Wales. He was made a member of the Order of Australia in 1994 and is a recipient of the Centenary Medal. He is currently an adjunct professor at University of Western Australia. Robert, thank you for joining me today.
Tanya, it's a real pleasure and it's terrific to recognise the World Elder Abuse Day, so thank you.
I mentioned earlier that this episode we are concentrating on the relationship of trust that defines elder abuse. And in particular, I want to talk about powers of attorney. A power of attorney is a legal document that gives a person authority to act for you, to manage your assets and make financial and legal decisions on your behalf. It is a very powerful position, so obviously you are going to appoint someone you trust. But still, where there is power, there is an opportunity for someone to abuse that power. Robert, would you say that is the case?
Oh, absolutely. In relation to elder abuse, what we know is the vast majority of abuse for older people occurs by family members. And in the matters that come to our commission, about 55% of all those matters are dealing with adult children, sons and daughters, who are in some way abusing their parents or older relatives. And that's a great tragedy. But even beyond that, it's about siblings, brothers and sisters, and sometimes, you know, close friends and neighbours. But also it is about attorneys under powers of attorney and even guardians under guardianship orders. One thing they all have in common is what you've highlighted is trust. It's a breach of trust. And yet, it's very important that older people, people that are facing the real prospect of frailty, dependency, increased, you know, issues around capacity, do in fact place their trust through powers of attorney, during powers of attorney and guardianship orders and so on, in those relatives. So it's a very tricky space. But that power dynamic, when it goes wrong, it goes very wrong. And financial abuse is only one area where we see very substantial misuse of that power. And tragically, as you get older, you become more dependent, and that power shifts from the individual, the older person, to the person they trust.
You've made a really good point there, which is the lesson to take away is not to do a power of attorney or enduring guardian. People do need those documents and they are beneficial to have in place because you choose who you appoint. But we need to address the way they are managed.
Well, absolutely. I think we've got to come to a recognition that as we grow older, most of us will have three things happen to us. We will get frailer. We will become more dependent on others. And for many of us, our capacity will start to slip. And for us, we see the greatest area of abuse around 75 to 85 years of age. Now, you don't want to wait until you get to that age. You don't want to not have in place the protections, like the power of attorney, to enable you to live your life well. So what we're trying to do is to get people to understand that they do need to act early. They do need to get their legal circumstances in order. Powers of attorney are important. Enduring powers of attorney are very important. But you've also got to be very careful about what you're doing, who you're giving that power to, who's going to be around to make sure that person that you've given that attorney to is acting in your best interest, you've also got to have a bit of a weather eye as to what happens if it goes wrong. Now, unfortunately, most of us wait far too long for that to happen.
So hopefully some of the cases we're going to look at today will show people what they can do in all of those situations. And I want to add that it's not to say that all attorneys will perpetrate financial abuse against the person they are acting for. There are many attorneys out there who do their best every day and commit significant time and effort to looking after an older relative and making sure that that person, their finances are managed responsibly and they're taken care of. It's often a thankless job and they have my absolute deepest respect. So I do want to recognise that there are a lot of people out there doing it out of the kindness of their heart and they don't get the recognition they deserve. But today we are going to look at a few cases in which the attorney abused that relationship of trust in order to gain a benefit for themselves. And Robert is going to share with us advice on the role of the Ageing and Disability Commission and what they may be able to do to help. Smith versus Glegg. In September 2000, Daphne Smith was 84 years old. She was completely blind, had depression, and was estranged from two of her three daughters. The only daughter she had contact with was her daughter Marlene, who she relied on for all of her needs. Daphne had appointed Marlene as her attorney. When Daphne was 85 years old, she was moving out of her home and into a retirement village. It was around this time that Marlene took her mother to see a solicitor. Not only was Marlene appointed as her mother's attorney, she was also appointed as her son's attorney, and her son lived overseas. The solicitor thought they were acting for Marlene's son, Matthew, and that Marlene was given instructions through the power of attorney. During the appointment with the solicitor, Daphne signed documents transferring her house to Matthew for no money. She signed the documents even though she couldn't read them because she was blind. Later, Daphne said that she thought she was transferring her house to her daughter Marlene and only for a short time to avoid paying a large bond at the retirement village. She said that Marlene had promised to transfer it back once Daphne had settled into the village. A year later, Marlene, once again acting as her son's attorney, sold the house for $180,000 and kept the proceeds. It is unclear whether Marlene's son Matthew ever knew that the house had been in his name, even for a short time. Marlene used the proceeds to buy herself a house. When Daphne was 88, she reconciled with her other two daughters. The arrangement was discovered by one of Daphne's other daughters, who assisted her mother to get help. Daphne cancelled Marlene's appointment as attorney and started legal proceedings to get her house back. Marlene was ordered to pay Daphne the $180,000 plus interest, working out to be about $235,000. Now, this was a case that was heard in the Supreme Court of Queensland, which had the authority to order that compensation in that case. Robert, we have this terrible situation where the older person may not realise that they have been the victim of financial abuse or may not have the resources to seek help for themselves, which highlights the importance of other people identifying the abuse and assisting the older person to get help, but also for information to be made more accessible for people signing these documents. What can family and friends do if they know an older person is seeking to arrange for a power of attorney?
Well, I think it's very important that we encourage people that are becoming older or frailer to actually look at the appointment of an attorney under a power of attorney or an enduring power of attorney. And family members, I think, have an obligation to start to talk to their older relatives, their mum and dad, their brothers and sisters, about how their affairs are going to be managed as they get older, as they become more frail. And that becomes more urgent if there is starting to be signs that there is a lack of capacity emerging. And it might only be very, very early stages. So the first thing is to raise those issues with the older person. And remember it always, the older person has rights to exercise their own voice and choice in these matters. And so you can only give advice. You can't tell people what to do. You certainly should listen to what they're saying. The second thing is to obtain information which allows people to actually understand what our powers of attorney are. And there are very good resources now available, sometimes in public libraries, certainly through a number of the legal aid services, guardian and trustee offices throughout Australia, and also a number of community legal services such as Justice Connect, which operates in Victoria and New South Wales. There is now very good resource material. So before you even go to see the lawyer, there's information in easy-to-read language that tells you a bit about it. Thirdly, it is important that a lawyer is consulted, because a lawyer should not only just prepare the document for you, he or she should talk to you about your circumstances. What are the financial risks? And also start to ask questions about the character of the attorney you're going to appoint. So it might be your son or daughter, but does your son or daughter have gambling problems? Does your son or daughter have drug problems? Does your son or daughter have financial problems? All of those are red flags. And a good lawyer will actually try to, you know, to, run you through some of those risks. And finally, of course, to explain to you what the powers of attorney actually allow the attorney to do, whether it should be an enduring power of attorney, which continues on even if you've lost capacity, or whether or not there should be other sorts of considerations in relation to your financial or legal arrangements. So a lawyer is very important, but sometimes the early stage is just finding out information. And the good thing is there's lots of information available.
And when people are speaking to that lawyer, one thing I found in practice doing these for clients is that clients generally seem to be reluctant to ask questions of a lawyer. I totally encourage you, if you are sitting down with a lawyer to do a power of attorney or enduring guardian and you don't understand any of the document, if there's anything you've got a question of, ask the lawyer. They are actually there to make sure you understand everything. You are not in the wrong to ask a question. There's not a stupid question. Just do it.
Well, it's your life at stake. I mean, at the end of the day, powers of attorney allow people to deal with financial and other assets, and that's important. Enduring guardianship allows them to make decisions in relation to health and other matters. And enduring powers, as I said, persist even when you've lost mental capacity. So it's your life at stake. So it's important that you ask the questions. It's equally important that the advisors, whether they're lawyers or they're employees in the guardian trustee offices or whatever they might be, actually point out these sorts of very practical issues and questions. So I think what we find is a lot of people that have entered into powers of attorney, they don't actually understand the powers they've just given away. They certainly don't seem to understand that you can revoke the power of attorney. And enduring powers of attorney, despite the fact that lawyers must give this advice, I don't think they really understand what losing capacity actually means in a very practical sense and what the attorney can then do. But also, I think it goes back to a point I raised. You've got to ask a little bit about the person being appointed. And that's a bit tricky because everyone wants to think well of their sons and daughters. But, you know, the work we do, as I said, most of the matters of concern around older people is, in fact, things that older people's children, you know, do. Sometimes not intentionally, sometimes not maliciously. But at the end of the day, it is your life. And so you've got to know what powers you're giving, and you've got to think very carefully about who you're giving to. And the other point is who on the outer circle, the rest of the family members, friends or others, who are aware of these arrangements that can keep just a bit of an eye on what's happening.
That's a really good point. I think some people aren't aware that you can structure the power of attorney to suit your situation. So you might decide to appoint a son to be your attorney, but you might also appoint your sibling with them to monitor what the son is doing. So you can structure your appointments to suit the situation, and you shouldn't be worried about telling the solicitor, the person assisting you, that that's what you want to do.
Absolutely. You could also limit the power of attorney in terms of time frame. You don't have to give one that's just never ending. You can do one for a short time to see how it goes. You can give a power of attorney that specifically relates to specific assets or specific financial transactions or specific circumstances. Again, you don't have to give everything away early. You can do this on a gradual basis. Most of us don't do that. Most of us go in there, do the enduring power of attorney, walk out, never think about it again. But I do think now that we know that financial abuse is so significant, and we do know that, about one in six older Australians identify as having been abused in the last 12 months, we now really do have to start to treat the abuse of older people seriously. And part of that responsibility is with the older person, and of course part of that responsibility is with their family, friends and those that care for them.
Well, that leads into my next question, which was, in the case we just looked at, it was only when Daphne reconciled with her other daughters that those dodgy transactions were discovered, which highlights the greater risk for older people without close relatives and friends, because apart from relatives and friends, who can help in these situations?
Well, in relation to the work that the Commission does, it's very interesting to those who ring our helpline. And in relation to issues of concern around older persons, the first group are other relatives. So that's the biggest group. Brothers and sisters that want to ring up and say, I'm not sure that my brother or sister is actually doing the right thing by mum and dad. But the second biggest group are frontline workers, medical practitioners, health workers, people that are providing home care services, community service workers, local council operators that operate senior citizens clubs. There's a whole network of people that are becoming better informed, and they're starting to observe signs of all forms of abuse, including financial abuse. So we're now starting to see a much bigger group of people that have got an eye on this issue, and our work is to try to encourage them to actually act when they start to see the early signs of abuse. The second one area is banks and financial institutions. You know, one of the areas where the banks are really doing a very good job is, in fact, starting to identify vulnerable customers. And in most of the major banks, there are, in fact, specific branches or units that are dealing with vulnerable customers, or they've got what they call customer advocates. We've been working with the Australian Banking Association and the banks generally, and it's an area where they have a very clear vested interest. Their frontline workers are becoming much more attentive to signs that something's not right. Previously, they didn't know what to do with it. Now they've got internal mechanisms, and of course, they can refer matters to us and like agencies around the place. So I think we are starting to see that. And the third thing is there are points which we've identified where older people themselves disclose matters. An example of that is on hospital discharge. So if you're an older person, you're not meant to be discharged from hospital unless there's a discharge plan. And that's a point at which either nurse practitioners or social workers can actually ask the right questions. And very interestingly, older people will disclose issues at that point. Why? Family members aren't around. Illness creates its own vulnerability and, you know, you're willing to speak. But also, I hope that our nurse practitioners and social workers are asking the right questions. And in fact, in some hospitals, there are actually lawyers embedded in those hospitals under what they call the health justice arrangements and partnerships. So I think what we're starting to see a broader group of people that are starting to identify not only the issue, but also the signs. And most importantly, there's someone to take that to.
There is one organisation called Hairdressers with Heart.
Correct.
Which I love the idea of, because it's training up hairdressers to be able to identify elder abuse and assist their clients, because people go in for a haircut all the time. And if it's an older person and you chat with them, you find out what they're doing if they identify abuse.
Look, it's terrific. And you see, I would never have thought of that years ago. And yet what it is, what's the common feature in that is it's where an older person is likely to disclose. Hairdressers, for reasons beyond our understanding, is a place where people disclose everything, including domestic violence and family violence and all sorts of other things. Another one is community transport. You know, they're in the car, they're going to, you know, a health service or some other service. They'll talk to the drivers. So it's anywhere where an older person, in this case, is likely to reveal. They won't say, I'm being abused, but they'll use language that gives you reason for concern. Now, if you're a taxi driver, you're not going to report it. But if you're constantly picking that person up, as a like a community transport, or you're a hairdresser that constantly hears these stories, it's absolutely a great place to actually see what's happening and then to respond. And the point about responding is it's not putting in a formal report. It's not reporting the matter to the police. It's actually ringing up an organisation such as ourselves or, you know, Seniors Rights Service, or, you know, various community legal centres and what have you, just to say, I'm concerned. You don't have to say, I think abuse is happening, but you can say, I'm hearing things, I'm seeing things, I'm worried about it. She's not what she used to be. She's not, you know, she's not looking like she used to. And so our message is, you don't have to form the view that it's abuse. That's my job.
Yeah.
That's the police's job. That's someone else's job. Your job is to simply say, I'm concerned enough to want to raise and discuss this matter with somebody else.
Western versus Mail. It was another concerned daughter who came to the aid in the case of Weston versus Mayle. In 2009, Maisie Mayle was 89 years old. She was not coping at home, had a recent heart attack, was having panic attacks, and was not managing her medication. She was discharged from hospital to a nursing home, and the medical opinion was that she needed to stay in the nursing home, she needed higher care. Now, this is one of those situations where doing the right thing makes you the bad guy, because Maisie's daughter Gillian was ready to follow the medical advice and knew that Maisie's house had to be sold to pay the $350,000 nursing home bond. From then on, Maisie blamed Gillian for selling her house and moving her into a nursing home. Maisie's son Philip put up some resistance but eventually conceded to the move. After the decision was made to sell Maisie's house, there was an argument between Gillian and Philip. Maisie had told her daughter that she wanted to loan Philip $200,000 to pay off the mortgage on his workshop. Gillian was concerned about this and suggested that an independent person should manage Maisie's money to avoid Maisie losing her pension. But Philip didn't want anyone else involved. He wanted to do it himself. Later, during the court hearing, Philip claimed that the loan to him was all his mother's idea and that he hadn't suggested it. On the 1st of September 2009, Maisie was going to her home that day to sort out her possessions and then Gillian would bring her back. However, at midday, there was a further note on Maisie's medical record. The note said, quote, Maisie did not leave until 1200 hours. Son and lawyer visited to sort out affairs. Explain to son, Phil, that Jill, daughter, is waiting for Maisie at Maisie's home to sort out all her possessions. Son went on to say, I don't care what Jill is doing. I have organized for Mum to sort out her affairs with the lawyer today, and Jill can bloody wait. End quote. 2 weeks later, Maisie saw a solicitor and executed a power of attorney appointing her son, Philip. Up until then, Gillian had been looking after Maisie's finances and making sure all of her mother's bills were paid. When Mrs. Mayle gave evidence about the reason for the change of power of attorney, she said that she was not happy with her daughter at this time and was angry at the way in which she was managing her life. The possibility is that part, at least, of Maisie's motivation in making the change was her distress at having to leave her family home and move to a nursing home, as well as parting with some of her possessions, all of which she blamed on her daughter. But Philip she referred to as her tower of strength. At the auction of the house, Gillian spoke to her mother about the new power of attorney and stated that her mother told her that she didn't understand what she had done and she hadn't wanted to change it in the first place, but she had felt pressured. That night, back at the nursing home, Maisie asked a staff member for help to get an independent person to look after her affairs rather than a family member. Maisie met with a social worker. The social worker's notes recorded, quote, met with Mrs. Mayle and daughter Jill Weston. Issues involving newly drawn up enduring power of attorney with son without Jill's knowledge with lawyer. Mrs. Mayle distressed and didn't fully understand the implications of what she did. She now wants a family meeting to resolve the issues, end quote. The manager of the nursing home met with Maisie to discuss her concerns and also made a file note of this. I'm going to read the file note in full because I found it quite interesting. Quote, I spoke with Maisie Mayle following an email to the nursing home social worker advising Maisie would like to speak to someone independent. In view of my discussion with Maisie after her son's visit, I was concerned for Maisie as I wondered if she had realized the impact of changing the power of attorney from both children to the son entirely. I visited Maisie and she was clearly distressed about the impact this decision had on Jill. Maisie stated several times to me she did not fully understand the enormity of her decision and she wanted to die. She also felt that everybody was hovering over her for her money. Maisie spoke at length about what would happen to her money after she died. However, son Philip wanted to borrow some money from her after the house was sold for his own mortgage. I tried to explain to Maisie she may need to get some financial advice as this could affect her pension. Maisie did not seem to grasp what I had to say or the implications of lending her money. Maisie clearly stated she wanted some independent advice. End quote. The nursing home arranged for someone from Aged Rights Advocacy Service to meet with Maisie and set up a meeting to learn about having her finances managed independently. Around the same time this was happening, Maisie was still seeing her son and there were still discussions about the loan. In evidence, Maisie agreed that she was going to loan Philip a sum of $200,000 with interest payable every month, but she could not remember how much that would be. She said that he was going to do it by law, it would be very secure. In early December, Philip ordered staff at the nursing home not to let Gillian visit Maisie. Gillian initiated court proceedings, and there was a court-ordered injunction preventing Maisie from entering into the loan with Philip. The same day that order was made, Maisie did a new will, leaving her whole estate to Philip. Maisie trusted her son so much that when he lied about Gillian, she believed him, and this caused her to alienate herself from her daughter, in turn making her more reliant on Philip and more vulnerable to him. Maisie was unlikely to ever confront her son for fear of losing his care and assistance, and it was only the intervention of the nursing home which led to the abuse being exposed. The court appointed the public trustee to take possession of and manage Maisie's estate. Isolation and alienation can make an older person more vulnerable to abuse and make abuse harder to detect. What can be done to address isolation?
Well, the greatest risk for older people is this, and it's an expression that many older people use, is older people say, I've become invisible, and worse, I've become voiceless. So my job and your job and our job is to give voice and presence to older people. And so for people to have voice and presence is they have to actually be connected with other people. And so one of the things that we need to do is to ensure that older people are actually socially connected, whether that's through formal community service organisations, whether it's through, you know, bridge clubs or whatever it might be, or whether it's just through friends that are constantly in their life, asking questions, visiting from time to time, asking people out. And it sounds simple, but it's actually very important because the greatest risk to an older person in relation to financial and other abuse is that they become isolated. The second thing is with people that are abusing older people is they do what they do in domestic violence and family violence matters is they reduce the self-esteem of the individual. They say to people, well, you're not capable of doing this. You know, you don't know what you're doing. You're making the wrong decisions. You're not being, you know, fair to the family. They put the guilt back on the older person. And without other supports coming in and supporting you, encouraging you, believing, you know, in you, that's very difficult and it demeans. So abuse has a pattern. Sometimes abuse is because the person simply can't care for the older person. But abuse of financial abuse, there is this pattern where the individual is diminished in some way, shape or form. But many people don't know that's happening to them at the time. So it's very important that we keep older people connected and we connect them to people that are genuinely interested in well-being beyond the immediate carer, which is important. The second thing is we need to absolutely make sure the carer is okay, because a lot of the abuse that occurs in this space is because carers are simply out of their depth. And that occurs to attorneys under power of attorney. One of the things we find is a lot of attorneys have no idea what their roles are. They don't know what their responsibilities are. Frankly, they're not capable of being attorneys, really. And they just get out of their depth. And what happens then is they start to make very bad decisions. And that can occur even in the financial space. So again, we've got to support the carers in these relationships. But lastly, we do have to give older people access to information. So they need to know where they can go. And that becomes more tricky, especially if they're starting to lose capacity. But we've got to constantly tell people there is a place you can go and ask questions. There's a place you can go and raise concerns. And the commission is, the Ageing Disability Commission in New South Wales is just one of those places. But so too are the peak bodies like Council of the Ageing, you know, and as I said, Seniors Rights Services and many of those other organisations.
What can an older person do to address their own isolation? Because I think we can sometimes recognise in ourselves that we haven't got a large social support group or that we're spending too much time at home. If an older person thought, I should address that, how could they go out into the community? Where are places for them?
Well, surprisingly, and this is really a very important thing, is older people connect locally. I don't. And many of my generation don't, and many of the younger generation certainly don't. But older people do. And one of those areas, frankly, is the public libraries. The public libraries are increasingly attentive to this issue of elder abuse. They're creating forums, collaboratives, information, even activities for older people. And so the local council is actually a very important starting point. The local council also knows all of the services that are available. And so in the work that we've been doing, we've been encouraging what we call collaboratives with interagency networks. And they always involve the local government, the local police, the local health community services. So actually, strangely enough, the libraries are very important. And in fact, we're in fact going to increase our presence in local libraries in throughout New South Wales. So there's no one answer to that. But actually, local government, local councils, local community services, local neighbourhood centres are a terrific source of information, and they don't judge. They simply are there to help support and, keep you well.
There's also, if you have mobility issues or if you can't get out of the house, there are services that people can sign up for to link into people.
Look, absolutely. One of the issues in relation to abuse is that we often find that the person has become increasingly isolated. And a lot of our work, apart from, trying to resolve, if it's financial abuse, those issues, and they're very difficult to resolve, let me tell you, it's often about trying to get support services into the mix, new services, different services. And I've got to say, in relation to, the service providers, they're generally very good. We have a lot of success in rearranging the support services for the carer and for the older person or the person with a disability. It's not always exactly what you need, but service providers are out there, and there are a lot of them. Now, to navigate that system, we and other organisations can help do that. But we find a lot of the pressures that are occurring inside families are in relation to the lack of supports or services. Having said that, financial abuse is very tricky because it's often hidden. It's not something older people talk about. And frankly, there's not an immediate support system to help you if you have been financially abused, other than the sort of formal services we've been talking about. So financial abuse generally becomes discovered over time. And as I say, it's a tricky space. But nevertheless, there are agencies out there now that can support people.
And I'd like to give a bit of a shout out to Red Cross Telecross Service, where you can, my understanding is, you can arrange to get a phone call every day where they check in on you and make sure you're still safe in your own home. And there's also the Community Visitors Scheme, which I'm a member of a community visitor program where I was matched up with an older person in an aged care facility who had no friends or family, and I've been visiting Betty for about 5 years now. I would highly recommend anyone to join that scheme because it's like getting a new member of the family. It's absolutely lovely, and they need more volunteers all the time. So anyone thinking, is there something I can do? Red Cross Telecross needs volunteers, and look at your community visitor program. See if there's something that you might like to volunteer for.
So that community visitor program is run through the aged care system, and it's very good. But again, it's about trying to establish relationships beyond the immediate carer, and that's really very important. It's the single message that's recurring through this podcast. That is that you have to be connected beyond the immediate carer for as long as that can, transpire.
Do you have any suggestions for older people wanting to restore relationships with family members?
So the Commission, the Ageing Disability Commission in New South Wales, spends most of its time trying to restore or improve relationships that have gone wrong. So even in financial abuse, it's not always the case that it was an exploiter. Now, there are people out there right at the moment who are deliberately targeting older people. They target them. They see them in, for example, in poker machine venues, in clubs and hotels. They identify particular vulnerable older people, and they target them. And they are out to do great damage. The vast majority of people we find in financial abuse, however, didn't start off that way. So it is about relationships. Often they've started off as being the carer. They'll say to the person, I'll help you with your banking and internet financing arrangements. But then it starts to change. They start to take a bit here and a bit there for the grandchildren, a bit more, you know, for the school fees, a bit more for the mortgage. Until the end, they actually try, they take most of the inheritance because they think they're entitled to it and they're not prepared to wait. So one of the great challenges for us in this space is trying to deal with relationships. Sometimes that means that the relationship with the offending party has to cease in some way. But more often than not, it's actually about trying to change those relationships. So we have a memorandum of understanding with Relationships Australia, which provides elder mediation. And it's specifically designed, funded by the New South Wales and Commonwealth governments, to deal with family dysfunctionality where the family can't resolve the issues themselves. So we use that service. Sometimes it's actually by some of the community support service providers can actually try and work through those arrangements. But often the relationships have so soured that, in fact, it does require external help or assistance. So groups like Relationships Australia and others are becoming more and more important in this space.
There are huge benefits to utilise these kind of services before things get too bad. It's kind of once you realize there's issues in the relationship and there might be some breaches of the power of attorney that you know of, don't turn a blind eye to it. Consider using these mediation services. And one thing I found out about Relationships Australia, the brilliant elder mediation services they provide, when I've offered it to clients in the past, they've said, my child will never agree to that. But they still take you on, even if your child hasn't agreed yet, because they can do some initial work with you. So even if you think your child will never agree, I still recommend reaching out to these services to get some ideas and support on what you can do.
Well, the reality is if you don't change the relationships into something that is both safe and healthy, it will get worse. Abuse follows particular patterns, and abusers never stop abusing until they're stopped. And abuse never gets any better. So there has to be things that change the relationship, change the circumstances. Sometimes that's legal intervention. Sometimes that is actually having a guardian appointed, a financial manager appointed external to the family. Sometimes it's by bringing other family members into it. But sometimes it actually does require, as you say, mediation by a third party. And sometimes it frankly fails. And that really is a real problem in this space. The other thing is, it's not just the relationship between the son and daughter and the older person. What we've experienced is it's between all of the siblings. And so, invariably, it's not the relationship between the son and the daughter and the older person. It's actually all the other members of the family who have now taken hostile positions. And in that space, the older person is exceptionally vulnerable because everyone else is trying to tell them what to do and what's good for them, and none of them can agree. So you just need a circuit breaker. Sometimes lawyers can do that too. Good lawyers nowadays are more than just advisors in relation to the actual documents. They do try to assist in actually creating a health and safety environment, we would hope. If you're dealing with older people, it's an essential part of legal practice.
So we've talked a bit about some of the services that are available to older persons or to people in the community who suspect that an older person is being abused. But let's look at regional areas and where there might be a lack of services and options. What can people in those regional areas do?
So if it's just simply seeking advice, of course you can ring an agency like the Ageing Disability Commission, and that's what we're here for. Or if you've got a suspicion, you can ring the National 1800 Elder Help Line, which is there. So there's a national line. Just look up elder abuse and you'll find it. But also you can just ring up some of the groups like Seniors Rights Services that operate right throughout country areas as well. Now, admittedly, at the beginning is a telephone conversation, but they have networks of volunteers. They often have centres and services out there, or they will know who is in that area. So at first glance, you say, well, there's nothing out there. But what we've discovered is actually there's quite a lot out there, but it won't be necessarily obvious to you. The other point that I re-emphasise is local government is actually very helpful in this space. For reasons which are not yet clear to me, local governments have continued to have an interest in and a responsibility for the care of older people in their communities. A lot of them got out of lots of other things. You know, they got out of childcare, they've got out of a whole lot of things they're involved in, And some of us might think that's not a good idea. But they have stayed in this area of ageing. So again, I think in regional areas, local governments, the advocacy bodies like Seniors Rights and others still are very, very important contact points, at least initially. All that aside, I think that governments again have to accept that elder abuse is with us and its recognition as a serious social problem is going to grow and grow and grow, and we are ill prepared for that. So without saying, you know, it's all about resources, it is about actually getting government to understand this is a bit like domestic violence and child protection, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, and it will become a serious social problem, which we have to respond to in a much more effective way.
Something that a social worker taught me was that when I moved, I work predominantly in Newcastle, and when I moved there, I wanted to find out what services were available for older people. And my friend, who's a social worker, said, well, just go on the council's website, they will have a guide. And I'm like, sorry, what? And so I went on the brochure, I went on the council website, and there's a brochure of services and programs for older people. There was one on the Central Coast, there was one in Newcastle. So I didn't know it, but it's absolutely handy. It's brilliant. So that's one thing you can look for as well. In the case we discussed just then, it was really good to see how the staff at the nursing home supported Maisie to get help. However, in a research paper by Kelly Purser, Tina Cockburn, and Elizabeth Ulrich, which I'll link in the notes, they found that although victims of abuse were often residents in aged care facilities, the aged care staff rarely identified the abuse. Why do you think that might be?
I think there's a couple of reasons. Firstly, abuse can take place within the aged care services themselves, generally by staff or volunteers, and of course the Royal Commission highlighted a number of those issues. But abuse can also take place by family members or friends whilst the person is in an aged care facility. And I think up until now, there's been a real reluctance by frontline workers to raise issues of concern. Partly it's driven by this fact that the actual client of the aged care service always tends to be the family. The actual resident is the older person. But if you look at the way in which decisions are made about where an older person resides, it's family members. And so if it's the family members that are causing the abuse, in many senses, the aged care provider says they're the clients. And that's one of the issues. The second thing is a bit of a fear that most of us stop short of actually saying what's happening is abuse. And what we're trying to say is, well, you don't have to make that decision. But if you're a frontline worker and there are things that are clearly happening that are worrying, troubling, which are adverse to the interests of that resident, then there is an obligation at least to raise that through the management system of the aged care facility or to organisations such as ourselves. If you say to a frontline worker, when you see abuse, you should do something, that'll never happen. Because in their minds, they say, well, I'm not quite sure it's abuse. I'm not quite sure what's really happening. And that's the point at which you've got to intervene. So what we're doing is we're trying to make sure that in every induction program that's offered by every aged care provider and every disability service provider in New South Wales, there'll be a small segment around elder abuse or the abuse of people with disability, so that staff become comfortable with not being experts in abuse, not forming the view that it's abuse, but saying something's not right and I've got to do something about it. The third factor, however, is you could lose your client. Now, that's true. If you're a home care provider and your organisation or your workers report that there's been abuse from family, there is a risk you'll lose the client. But the problem with that is the reverse is worse. That is, you actually leave one of your clients in a position that is unsafe and unhealthy. And, of course, that's morally completely reprehensible. So we say to providers, commercial interests can never trump the interests of the well-being of the person. And most providers, got to say, get that. So there are lots of factors in there. But I have to say, frontline workers, truly very, very, very important in identifying abuse, not only by their colleagues, but also by, family members and other carers.
Downey versus Langham. In 2010, Mrs. Gwen Downey appointed her niece, Diane Langham, as her attorney. The terms of the power of attorney document stated that at all times, the attorney must act in Gwen's best interest and for her benefit. 4 years after appointing her niece as her attorney, Gwen Downey died, and Gwen's son Rodney was appointed as her executor of her estate. It was Rodney who discovered numerous suspicious bank withdrawals from his mother's bank account, including withdrawals made after his mother's death. All up, Rodney worked out that about $120,000 was unaccounted for. Rodney sought an explanation from the niece Diane. Diane denied any wrongdoing and said that she had not kept any accounts or receipts during her years as Gwen's attorney. Rodney continued to seek an explanation and pointed out that several of the transactions had clearly not been for his mother's benefit, such as almost $4,000 paid to Summit Bathrooms for work done on the niece's property. There was also cash withdrawals in amount of $500 and $1,000 made over quite short periods of time. Nowadays, cash withdrawals can be suspicious, especially in such large amounts. When the niece continued to refuse to provide an explanation for the transactions, Rodney initiated legal proceedings against her. In court, Diane admitted to spending money from Gwen's bank accounts that she shouldn't have, but said that it would only have been about $41,000, not the $120,000 Rodney was claiming. The niece provided no evidence to show how she got her figure of $41,000, whereas Rodney provided documentation from Gwen's bank account to show he came up to the figure of $120,000. The court noted that the law does not always impose an obligation on the attorney to account for the transactions they have done in the role of attorney. Even where an account is required, it will not necessarily follow that an attorney who is unable to give an account will necessarily be required to refund the principal for the expense, unfortunately. In this case, where the attorney admitted to using Gwen's money for her own benefit, and where there were numerous withdrawals, some of which were quite substantial, from which it can be inferred that it was not for the deceased's benefit, it was held that Diane should be ordered to provide account of the monies received and dispersed from Gwen's bank account, in particular those transactions Rodney had identified. This case demonstrates that sadly too often the misappropriation of funds is only discovered after the person's death. This is because the power of attorney is being used because the principal does not have capacity to manage their own finances or to oversee the actions of the attorney in dealing with those finances. They don't have capacity, therefore the attorney is required to act, but because they don't have capacity, they can't oversee what the attorney is doing. So, Robert, some children may believe that they have to wait until after their parent has died to do anything. Is that the case?
Well, if you wait until the person dies, it's invariably going to be almost impossible to, in fact, redress the wrong that's being done. You can do it, and this court case indicates that that's possible. But really what you've got to do is act much earlier than that. I think the lack of accountability by attorneys is quite a serious issue. The law is inadequate in relation to this area. Many attorneys do not properly account for what they've been doing. And I think the law is very vague about that, or in fact completely silent in relation to that. The second thing is, yes, you can in fact intervene. A family member can intervene to put in a request to the appropriate tribunal in New South Wales at NCAT to vary the power of attorneys, to raise concerns around the attorney. So you can, in fact, act better if the person that actually gave the power, you know, terminates the power. But if that doesn't happen, you can intervene. And thirdly, you can come to agencies such as ourselves. So waiting for the person to die is, in fact, the worst outcome, because after they're dead, it's very difficult to redress the wrong that's been done. But again, understanding what the actual power is, if you are concerned, you can certainly raise concerns prior to the person's death and, frankly, prior to the person becoming completely incapacitated. If you wait for the person to become completely incapacitated, then, in fact, everything becomes much more difficult.
I was really disappointed in this judgment to see the court expressly state that even where the attorney has failed to keep account, that they may not be ordered to reimburse the principal. Oh. Especially when the power of attorney document itself says that the attorney must keep accounts. I think it's something we're not holding attorneys to and that we should.
Well, what basically is happening with courts? Courts are the last place to actually understand the extent of the abuse that's occurring in our society. Courts, both judges and juries, are very slow to understand what's actually happening in the real world. And so they're often very empathetic to the attorney that says, really, you know, I wasn't really sure what I was doing. I was doing a favor for my mum and dad. You know, she kept telling me to do this and to do that. Of course, she's now dead. So how do we know that she actually said you should do this or do that? And we're seeing quite a lot of court cases fail.
Yeah.
Even criminal cases, there's a lot of acquittals. Now, I expect that to continue for some time. That's exactly what's happened in abuse cases for children before we had new laws and in the cases of domestic violence. So eventually courts catch up, start to understand the nature of the abuse and frankly become a little less empathetic to some of the stories that are being told by attorneys and carers. All that aside, it is a tricky space. You know, it is sometimes true that the older person does in fact want or not want certain things to happen, and sometimes they are not in their own best interest. So you've just got to be a bit open to the fact that it's not as clear. What is clear is most people that are attorneys don't actually understand their duties and responsibilities. The law is not as clear as it needs to be. And the third problem is if there's nobody else interested in that person's well-being, then bad things can happen and not be found until, as you see in this case, they're dead. And that's far, far, far too late.
I think we also overlook that once it gets to the court systems, evidence is so, so important. And when we're looking at evidence, it's difficult to prove. I had a case where an attorney had misappropriated over $300,000 over about 7 years. And it's not just saying that and proving that. You have to go through every single transaction, even the ones that are only for $50, and say and prove that the principal didn't agree to that transaction.
Well, in fact, financial abuse is actually, I think we're ill prepared as a nation for about what's to happen. So banks and financial institutions are becoming much more active. Organisations like ourselves are around. Lawyers and attorneys generally are becoming much more interested and active in this space. But the problem with it is, once you've identified that it is potentially abuse, as you rightfully say, the evidence trail that you have to go down and what you have to provide is enormous. So it's exceptionally resource intensive. And I don't think as a nation we've come to grips with how we're going to deal with the level of financial abuse that has probably always existed, but now it's being found out, now it's being talked about, and frankly now institutions like banks and financial institutions are actually taking action. So the one thing I know about this case is that of all the abuse areas, it's probably the most difficult in terms of resourcing the actual investigation. And it's the most difficult to actually find the solid evidence. That's not to say, you know, it's easy in any other case, but financial abuse is a really tricky space.
Kenneth Charles Ward versus Brian Charles Ward. Kenneth Ward was 77 years old at the time of the events in this case. He was a widow with two adult sons, Brian and Anthony. Sadly, neither of the sons look too good in this case. In 2001, Kenneth was living in his home in Marrickville. His son Anthony and Anthony's partner were also living with him. In 2003, Kenneth was physically assaulted by Anthony and his partner. There were criminal and DV proceedings brought against Anthony and his partner. Kenneth was estranged from his other son Brian. They hadn't had any contact in over a decade. But after his falling out with Anthony, Kenneth reconnected with Brian. Kenneth made a will which made Brian his primary beneficiary, and in June 2003, he appointed Brian as his attorney under a power of attorney. He soon after sold his Marrickville property and purchased a property in Kings Park that was registered in the name of Kenneth, Kenneth's de facto partner Iris, and Brian. Kenneth had $166,000 left over from the sale of his house. Brian offered to invest it for him. He promised he would get a return of $20,000 interest every 18 months. Acting as Kenneth's attorney, Brian entered a loan agreement in which Kenneth loaned the sum of $140,000 to the company of Brian's son, David. It appeared that David's company was looking to develop residential property in Campbelltown to have 69 residential and 4 commercial units. The loan agreement stated that it did not have to be repaid until 2009, and even then, only if David had sold enough units to pay back the loan. The first payment of interest of $20,000 was paid to Kenneth in 2004. When the next payment was due in 2007, it wasn't paid, and Kenneth questioned this. His son Brian said that he would see what was happening, but he didn't do anything. A year later, Brian finally said that maybe he could pay Kenneth $5,000. By this time, the relationship was starting to crumble. Brian was not returning Kenneth's calls. In 2008, Kenneth revoked the power of attorney and demanded his $140,000 back from Brian. Brian made an application to the Guardianship Tribunal for a review of the revocation of the power of attorney. He was basically arguing that his father didn't have capacity to cancel the power of attorney. Fortunately, this application was dismissed. Kenneth started legal proceedings against his son to get his $140,000 back plus interest. Brian did not attend the hearing to make his own case. The court considered the terms of the loan agreement, that the borrower only had to make payments out of the proceeds of the sale of the units, if and when those proceeds became available. There was no evidence before the court as to the status of the sales. Had there been this evidence available, the court said that this would have made it harder for Kenneth to establish his case. However, because Brian wasn't there to raise a defence, the sum of $140,000 was repayable to Kenneth with interest. In relation to the one-third interest in the Kings Park property that Kenneth had put in Brian's name, it was set aside due to unconscionable dealing on the basis that Kenneth had a special disadvantage. Brian knew about it and took advantage of it to get a one-third interest in the house. Again, the court said that if Brian had defended his case, he might have been able to show that Kenneth didn't have a special disadvantage. But because he didn't, Kenneth was able to succeed on that ground. Brian was ordered to pay Kenneth's cost of the proceeding. So, a really interesting factor in that case was Brian decided not to defend himself, and the court on both points stated that if Brian had decided to defend himself, Kenneth might have lost the case. So it illustrates an important point. You can terminate the appointment of your attorney at any time, provided you have the capacity to do this. Is this an issue you come across, and what would you do to raise awareness of this aspect?
The revocation of powers of attorney is really a very strong area of concern for us. Most people don't seem to be able to understand that they can revoke or how they can revoke. And it's not simply a matter of saying, I revoke the power of attorney and create a new one. In fact, the old power may continue to persist. But worse than that, even if legally it stops, the people to whom the power of attorney is produced, banks, financial institutions, real estate agents and all that, have no idea whether or not you've revoked it. And secondly, whether or not you've lost capacity. And of course, as I just said before, the powers of attorney, general powers of attorney, cease when a person's lost capacity. But who knows that? So revocation of powers of attorney is really important. And in many cases, we recommend that the powers actually be revoked. And what we're doing is we're developing a fact sheet now to actually take people through that. Now, I'm sure those fact sheets exist with a number of other organisations like Justice Connect and Legal Aid Services and so on. But it is important that people know they can revoke it. And in fact, they have to be quite proactive about doing that. So once you revoke it, you've got to actually tell the attorney that the power's been revoked. You may have to tell your banking or financial institutions that it's been revoked. If you've registered in New South Wales in relation to real estate transactions, you may need to tell the Land Registry Office. So there are things you need to do, not only to revoke the power of attorney, but let people know that you've actually revoked it.
One thing I recommend to my clients is that so long as you have capacity, you should control who has a certified copy of the power of attorney. So instead of trusting your attorney to have multiple certified copies to do with whatever they need to, you might say, only I'll have the certified copies. I'll give a copy to the bank. I'll give a copy to my real estate agent. And that way you know who has one and you know who to contact if you need to cancel it.
Yes, that's right. And I think other family members should also know that you actually have granted a power of attorney or an enduring power of attorney and or know the lawyers where they can contact them if there are particular issues. What tends to happen, I think, in a lot of these circumstances, is family members are not aware of those arrangements. And of course, in some senses, that actually creates its own tensions in the family when they say, well, why did you appoint Brian, but you didn't appoint me? So, you know, in some cases, attorneys, you know, suggest that they should appoint all the children as attorneys, which, you know, to act jointly, which I'm not quite sure is a great idea. But the whole thing here is people should know that you've got a power of attorney, that you've given it to somebody, and that if things start to look like it's going awry, they might be able to intervene or to take some action. But revocation of powers of attorney, yes, we deal with that a lot.
It's worth noting that the compensation of the principal in the cases highlighted today has been as a result of court action. This is a step that older people typically don't take for a range of reasons, including that it involves taking legal action against a family member. It can be incredibly costly. I emphasise that, incredibly costly. It can take months, if not years, of legal proceedings. And obviously, when you're paying to engage a lawyer for months or years, that's going to cost. It's intimidating and it's a difficult pathway to follow. Or the older person may no longer have capacity to instruct a lawyer. So obviously, court proceedings really are a last resort, and people shouldn't see them as an easy option or a solution. I think you should consider a lot of what we were talking about before. Get informed from the start, know what's in the document. If you're an attorney, know what your obligations are. Have that social network where people are seeing you and they know what's happening with your life. Try mediation if you need to. Revoke the attorney if you need to. And use the legal system as a last resort. At the start, I mentioned the amazing work thousands of attorneys do in Australia every day to provide financial management and care to a family member or friend. A lot of attorneys are thrown into the role without any training or advice on what they can and can't do, what their main priorities should be, or how to go about the job of being someone's attorney. The role can be really stressful, and sometimes the attorney may do the wrong thing, only because they don't have enough information or assistance. Robert, what is one final takeaway for people listening about how the Ageing and Disability Commission can help anyone concerned about the abuse of an older person?
Well, before I just talk about the commission, just one thing I think is there is reform. There's a push to reform the whole area of powers of attorney around Australia. And Kay Patterson, the Age Discrimination Commissioner with the Human Rights Commission, has been leading the charge, because many of the issues you've spoken about today and we've discussed arise because the power of attorney regime, by and large, around Australia is weak, and it needs to be strengthened and improved in a way that is able to empower the person, the older person in this case, or the person with a disability. In terms of the Ageing Disability Commission, it was formed so that people can act early. When you start to see the signs, you're concerned about it, then ring us. Ring the National Help Abuse Helpline, ring the Ageing Disability Helpline in New South Wales, because we can help you work through and we can actually start to see whether or not what we're seeing is really a problem, whether or not it can be dealt with in a very early way, in a very low intervention way, whether it's simply around changing relations or providing better services, or ultimately whether it is absolutely abuse, and it might even have a criminal element. So what we're really saying is that there now is an increasing number of places you can go to raise these concerns. And if you don't do that, then again, go to some of the advocacy bodies, the legal rights bodies that we've referred to, and they can give you guidance. But the most important things, if you see something that's not right, don't put it off. Don't wait, because it'll only get worse. Act early. And that's the best thing and the only thing we can really say. For the person, the older person, however, as you are starting to get older, start you really think about how you're going to live your life, how you're going to control, you know, aspects of life. Who do you want to have a say in how your life is going to be lived? That's a very hard issue for us to confront, but it would save a lot of problems for you, the individual, and for your families if you just take the time and the effort before these issues start to really become, problematic in your own lives.
That wraps up this episode. I want to give a special thanks to the New South Wales Ageing and Disability Commissioner, Robert Fitzgerald, for joining us for this episode and providing insight into the important work the Ageing and Disability Commission does. especially in recognition of World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, which is an important day to raise awareness of elder abuse and what we as a community can do to prevent and address abuse. If you are a victim of elder abuse, or if you are concerned that you might know someone who is, you can contact the Ageing and Disability Abuse Helpline on 1800 628 221.